Welcome to the HSCT Warriors Podcast, bringing voice to the journeys of HSCT Warriors worldwide. I'm Dr. Jen Stansberry Koenig, or Zen Jen, and so grateful to share this story with you. As we continue to grow the HSCT Warrior community, illuminate the invisibilities of autoimmune disease, recognize the possibilities of a future free from disease progression, connect through our shared experiences, and advocate for an inclusive society. We're so glad you've joined us.
Hi, Jen.
Hi, Allie. So great to have you back.
Thank you so much. Thank you for always asking me to do the season opener.
Oh my gosh, 11th season.
Oh my God, that's crazy.
It really is.
I can't believe it. I literally can't believe it's been that long.
And to be fair, I kind of skipped a season last year because I started a full-time job. And I just have not.
That's fantastic.
Yeah, but I have not found time until now. And of course, now we have people interested in sharing their story. And so I have to come back. I have to hold space. And I'm so glad that you're here to help us hold and open
that
space.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. I'm so happy to be here too.
It's always great to just check in and see, as we've said from the beginning, right? How a long-term experience, consistent check-ins with that long-term experience.
Right.
And how things are going. So I appreciate you always being willing to show up and share and tell us.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you. Well, I loved hearing that you were working full time. So what are you doing?
Oh my gosh. It's the easiest
teaching
job I've ever had. I am. So I'm not only am I working one full-time job, I'm also working three part-time jobs.
Oh my gosh, what are you doing?
Yeah, so I am teaching, but that's part-time. And then I evaluate grant projects. So those have been going on for a couple of years now, and I'm winding down one grant this year, and then there's 2 years left on the other grant. So they aren't terribly busy, but full-time I'm working at the middle school, which is only 5 minutes from my house. So I can be there early, and I'm done by 3 o'clock in the afternoon. And have the rest of my day.
That's terrific. That's wonderful. And I love that you are able to, after all these years, to be working that much.
Oh my gosh. I surprise myself every single day because I'm up at 5 to be at work by 6:30 a.m. And wow, I was never a morning person. What is happening?
Yeah, that's good. I'm a morning person. I'm not a night person. I've always been a morning person.
So tell us, I get up at tell us too. About your days and how you're doing.
I'm doing great. And I get up usually around 5:30 in the morning. And most days I'm at work by a little before 7. And I'm still living in Key West. And just really, I mean, how can you not, living a Key West life and, still working at my little, island health mecca, which is, to any part of wellness for me, health and wellness that I can be involved in is what makes me happy.
Mm. And that's, we have to find joy.
Yeah. And I've met great friends here, and I've met such incredible spiritual, health conscious people. So it was a great community to join. And I love that.
That is wonderful to find that acceptance and belonging.
And what else? My health is good. I really haven't had any, I haven't had a single MS setback since the transplant. I'm fully in remission still.
Wonderful.
And the interesting thing is that my last MRI, which was late spring, the radiologist who read it said that he said he compared it, and I didn't know this person, but he compared it to my previous studies, and he said that one of the lesions on my C2, C3, which was really why I did the transplant, because I had two lesions there, and it was just critical time. Mm-hmm. And he compared them, and he said he could not see it.
What?
He said he could not see it. Wow. And I didn't believe him. And then my neurologist, who I've been with for year, you know, 15 years, maybe, he said he looked at the film as well, because I made them email him the films, or, you know, I had them send him the CD, mm-hmm, because I'm in Florida and he's in Philly. They sent him my CD and he reviewed it and said he couldn't see it either.
Amazing.
So I was so shocked because I really didn't believe that could happen. And I almost called Dr. Burt to say, is this possible?
Mm. Well, why not?
You know, have you seen this? I could.
And
I
was,
yeah. I've talked to him a few times over the years, which is nice. Obviously talked to him, which I'm sure, you know, well, you have too, but mm, when the book, before the book came out and stuff, mm, he called me a few times and we spoke, but I thought like, oh, I wonder if I should call him and ask him about this, because is that really true? Or is it just like some kind of weird, like artifact thing? Or, but two people said they could not see it in comparison to the last studies.
How amazing. And those were the lesions that had you so scared.
Yes, that's the lesions that both my neurologist and Dr. Burt said, you know, one more attack on my cervical spine would paralyze me.
Uh-huh. So why don't we rewind a little bit for any of our new mm-hmm listeners who haven't maybe heard season one, episode one yet, to talk about, right, your journey with MS.
Sure. Let's see how I can make it somewhat brief. So I was diagnosed in 2002, and they feel that many of the doctors and my final, I went to three doctors, three neurologists for three. I wanted all these opinions. So for three different opinions on the diagnosis. And my final one was in New York at Mount Sinai's MS clinic there. And Fred Lublin, who runs Mount Sinai, was one of the original doctors in the Copaxone trials when it was coming out. He was one of the doctors who was part of kind of discovering Copaxone and one of the main doctors in that trial before it ever hit the market. And he did my final diagnosis. So that clinic feels that I have been living with MS probably since my teenage years. So, and when we talked about it and when we went through my whole history for about 3.5 hours, it made sense to a lot of symptoms that I had growing up and things that happened to me. It's, you know, said it was probably early signs of MS.
Sure.
And that it didn't really wreak its ugliness until my daughter was born. Mm. Because as we know, when a woman's pregnant and the hormones rise, it tends to hide any symptoms. Mm-hmm. You kind of feel pretty good.
Yes.
And when you then deliver the baby, your hormones shift and drop. And in that, is where symptoms start to show from that decline. So at the time that I was diagnosed, after my daughter was born, unfortunately, my ex-husband and I decided to get divorced. And the stress of the divorce, I mean, the doctor said it was more the stress on my body than even the pregnancy itself. Mm. The delivery. They said it was probably the constant stress from what I was going through emotionally that really triggered it. And wow. So I was diagnosed in 2002. Officially, I had gone to a lot. I had gone through a lot, as we all do, trying to find answers. And then it was just definitive diagnosis. And at the time, so I had symptoms for a long time, but then I was okay, on and off for a long time. I would go with periods of feeling great, and then, you know, as a traditional relapsing, remitting, then having like an episode. I had optic neuritis, which really was my main episodes in the beginning, was optic neuritis and headaches, lots of headaches and pain, which was really hard. Actually, the pain portion was very difficult because the doctors, every doctor was like, you know, in finding my final neurologist, I saw a lot of doctors. I went through a lot of neurologists between New York, Philadelphia, and Arizona, because I have a really, really strong personality. And when I don't like the way I'm being treated or being talked to or made to feel like I don't know about my own body, mm-hmm. I'll tend to look for another doctor. So
for you, that's hard for people to do.
It is hard. And I will circle back to that because I do want to say something about that. But in the process of, you know, really landing on my final neurologist that I've been with, like I said, for about 15 years, you know, they wanted to put me on medication right away. I refused it for 2 years because I was also living a very alternative life and I didn't know the medications. I didn't know what they would do to me. I didn't know the side effects. The only real thing that I got from them was that you could get suicidal tendencies from interferons, and knowing that I was already had, you know, was a single mom, then it was, maybe that's not a good idea. And also I had a background in suffering from depression, which was hereditary clinical depression. So they felt that wasn't a good choice. So I waited 2 years before I made a decision on the medication. And then in 2004, I had moved back to Philadelphia with my daughter from Arizona. And I had gotten really sick when I first moved. My daughter was only three, and she'd come home from preschool with strep throat, and then I got it. And it really flared a big attack, and I got really sick. And I made a decision to try the medication. So I went on Copaxone. I stayed on that for like 3.5 years. And then doing my shot normally, as I do before, I did before bed, one night I had a almost anaphylactic reaction to the shot, just out of nowhere. Because up until then, the only symptoms I had, the only side effects I had from Copaxone was site reactions, injection site reactions. Really bad, but I didn't have any other, like it didn't really make me sick. So I stayed on it. I didn't really know what it was doing for me either. And then when that happened, I had to go to the hospital. They couldn't identify why it happened. Mostly they just said, oh, it might've been a bad needle in the batch or something. Oh. So at the time, I was seeing a doctor in Philadelphia at Penn, University of Pennsylvania, MS clinic. And I had called down there to talk to the doctor and get an appointment right away because of what had happened. I felt it was pretty serious. And then he was away on vacation. And all I got from the nurse who called me back was take a drug holiday. So go off the medication for a few weeks. You're scheduled to come back here in August. This was in June. And then I called my old doctor in New York and he said the same thing, you know, let's just clean out your system. And then, you know, you can go there, you can come here and we'll have a new plan of action. So when I went off Copaxone, I discovered the bulk of my symptoms. So obviously for those years, it was doing something in control of my symptoms. However, I'm not sure why the doctors were doing this with me, but I was having MRIs like every 3 months.
Oh, that's a lot.
It's a lot of gadolinium. And, you know, sometimes they'd stretch it to 6 months, but I couldn't even count, Jen, the amount of MRIs I went through in those 3 years. I mean, it was just ridiculous. And the problem was I was taking this drug, but every MRI I had showed progression in my brain. Everyone. I just kept getting more lesions, more lesions, more lesions. So it really wasn't slowing down the disease. It might have been helping with some of the symptoms.
Right, masking it so that you could
function. But it wasn't, yeah. So I stopped the medication, and that's when I saw it really reared itself on what was happening in my body. So I started to get really sick, like doubled over sick. Like, I was away in Long Island with my family, and I couldn't function. Mm. My hair was falling out by the bagful. And my lips had swelled almost as if I had gotten like a lot of injections in them. Oh. They swelled really big and they were peeling. So it was like, not just when you get like chapped lips, you know, and you get little dry skin on your lips, they were peeling off in layers.
Oh.
It was the most, I don't know how to explain it, but it set me into the worst depression. I didn't know what's happening. We were collecting my hair in baggies and dating them by the day so that when we got back from our trip, I would be able to give them to my doctor and prove what was happening.
Good for you for even thinking of that. That's amazing.
And the other thing that was happening was I was born with like white blonde hair. I always had blonde hair, and my hair was turning really dark brown. And even when I was going to get highlights put in my hair, they couldn't keep it up. Like it would just, they couldn't keep up how fast this dark hair was coming in, was completely changing. And I went to the doctor and my hair was dark. And he said, I don't believe you. Like this is, I've never heard this. And I literally had to pull photos of growing up to show him like what I looked like. And he said, well, I've never heard of that. And I ended up going onto a lot of like forums online and finding out that there were tons of women on Copaxone who were going through the exact same thing.
Mm.
And so during that process of being sick the first time like that and being like so sick, I couldn't eat any food, any solid food. It just kept getting progressively worse and worse until I'd lost so much weight that at the time I was married to my second husband and people were calling him and texting him, you know, is she okay? People were talking, saying I was anorexic because the weight kept falling off me because I couldn't eat. And every time I tried to eat, it was like, I always used the analogy that it was like taking a straw and trying to put like a brick through a straw. It's impossible. You can't. When I swallowed food, what was happening was, which we discovered much later when they finally admitted me to the hospital for major testing, was that one of the nerves in my spinal cord, which was being damaged, which there was like this, I could be saying it wrong, so forgive me if I am, interstitial nerve that wraps around the side of you and goes towards the sphincter muscle at the base of your esophagus that empties food into your stomach, wasn't working. So even though they put me through all these tests and all, you know, a lot of GI, upper GI testing, they took tissue biopsies, they couldn't find anything physical. And I kept saying to them, and this is one of the points I want to make when I go back to, you have to, if there's nothing else, you must know your own body. Pay attention to your symptoms. Keep a log of them, a journal if you have to for the doctors. Or, and especially for yourself, which I had done all along since the beginning, I had kept a journal about what was happening so I could watch the progression on my own. And they couldn't find anything until finally I kept saying, you're not going to find anything physical. You're not going to find it. It's neurological. It's the nerve is being eaten away and it's not telling my stomach to digest the food, to empty the food. Mm-hmm. That's what's happening. And I couldn't believe, Jen, how many doctors I had to see before somebody believed me until they finally, and believe it or not, they didn't do an MRI until they finally hospitalized me and done all the other tests. They weren't even going to do the MRI on my spine. And I just lost it. And I finally got the MRI on my spine. And sure enough, there was a glaring lesion on my spinal cord that was active and causing all of this. So, you know, fast forward years later, that was in about 2006 and seven. So I ended up, you know, being really, really sick, not being able to eat for like 2 months. Everything that I had to be liquefied. And then I went back to the doctors in August and they decided that I should go on Rebif. Let's try the interferon. We think that'll help you.
And you were terrified at that point. Interferon.
I was terrified, but also I was terrified of what was happening to me.
Mm-hmm, sure.
And I had to do something. So I went on the Rebif and at about, so Rebif is three times a week, just for the listeners. And it's just subcutaneous shot. So I was doing my shots 3 days a week and I was having massive flu-like symptoms that didn't deteriorate. Like they never went away. So by the time I went to do my second shot and then my third shot, I was just sicker and sicker by the week. And about 6 weeks in, I started to develop these migraines. Now I had had headaches, but these were a totally different thing. And they sent me to New York to Columbia University's medical staff. And I went through the migraine. There's actually a migraine. I don't know if it still is at the time. There was a migraine clinic there. So I went to them. And, you know, don't eat aspartame, don't do this. But I really didn't get a lot of answers about how to cope with them or what to do. So once again, I went back home and my mom would come over every night and wrap these ice packs that would go around your head and tie on my head and hold me over a toilet so I could be sick from the pain. And my primary doctor at the time, I was on a cocktail of one Vicodin, three Advil, and a Xanax every 6 hours.
Goodness.
That was my cocktail to control the pain. And it helped. But it was a lot of pills.
Yeah.
And it was hard to live without them because I couldn't handle the amount of pain I was in. I was really struggling. And in February of 2008... I was barely functioning. I was barely functioning as a mother. I worked from home. I could barely work at all. I mean, I couldn't hardly get outside and do anything. I had lost so much weight and I had like a grayish tint to my, like, I just, my eyes were just not clear. My hair was falling out. And that, so they took me off at Rebif and put me on Avonex, which is basically the same drug, except it's into the muscle and it's once a week. So I was going to my doctor's office to have the nurse give me the injection. And by the fourth week, I was so, so sick that I couldn't take it anymore. So this one day in February of 2008, I was trying to make dinner and I was holding a pan and I lost control and dropped everything all over the floor. And I just broke down to my husband and I cried and I said, I can't do this. I can't. If I have to live like this, if this is my life and it's going to continually get worse, I don't want to be here. And I had enough pills in my house to easily put myself down.
Right.
And I really did. And then I made a decision and I paged my doctor who was in New York at the time. And I said, I'm done. I'm done. he said, look, stop the shots, give yourself a few weeks. You'll come here. We'll talk about a new plan. There's other options. I said, I'm done. I can't do this anymore. I am going to figure out something else for myself. I can't live like this. And if I have to live like this, I don't want to live. Mm. The next morning, I woke up and I said, okay, it's time to change my life. And I did. And for the next 8.5 years, I put myself into remission. My MRIs were stable for 8 years. So,
what was your trick?
I studied food. I used food as my medicine. Mm-hmm. And I thought to myself, most of these drugs that I was taking started as a plant. There was plants in these drugs. That was a base. Then there was all these things changed and added and this and that. And I thought, well, if I go back to that space and I can balance my body from the inside, then I can put myself into remission and stop this attack. And that's what I did. I changed my whole diet. I focused on everything I put in my mouth. I started exercising for the first time. I started building my strength. I started mindfulness, changing my thoughts, because we are what we eat and we are what we say we are. So I had to change the way I thought. Instead of being this incredibly sick person with MS, I had to go back to, I'm just Allie. And this is just a part of me. This isn't who I am. And I just stopped living like it was. And so for the next 8.5 years, I was in remission. And it was fantastic, or 8 years. And then in 2016, I went through an emotional setback. And the disease came back with the ugliest vengeance. Mm. I had all new symptoms, completely all new. And so for the next year, they couldn't get me into remission. I was in an active attack for almost a year. I was doing rounds of steroids, which were just deteriorating me. And at that point, my symptoms had gone from migraines and optic neuritis and pain to losing my speech at one point. I couldn't talk. I was drooling, constantly drooling, like I had a hole in my lip. I was losing balance. I had fallen a couple of falls. I thought it was like, oh, I tripped over my foot, or I tripped over this. Because it wasn't so much my gait that was affected. Mm-hmm. It was all these other little things. I lost use of, so I had gone numb from the neck down at one point. And it really hit my right arm, which is my dominant hand. And so I lost use of my arm for a little bit. I couldn't write. And I'd say the biggest hit was my digestion again and my cognition. So I was losing my ability to process and retain information. And I was also losing my ability to say the things that I was thinking. So I would have thoughts and I would want to say things, and I couldn't get them out. I just couldn't. And I think that the turning point for me was, I think it was Thanksgiving of 2016. And I was with a bunch of friends. We had friends in from New York, and we all went out for like this big dinner before Thanksgiving. And I remember sitting around the table with about 12 people. I was one of them. And it was fun, and there was all this conversation, and everyone was eating, and I couldn't eat. And I'm listening, and I couldn't contribute to the conversation. And I was trying to figure out what everybody was saying. And I was having so much trouble processing what was happening. And things just continually got worse in early 2017. There were so many things, Jen, that went bad. I couldn't even tell you. I was losing everything at that point.
And were you on a new DMT?
Nope. I was not on anything.
Still on food.
And yep. I had been on food. It had worked. Everything was great. And then it wasn't. Mm-hmm. And the disease. So then I was told that I was going into the second phase of MS. And because they couldn't get the attack under control for almost a year, they just said, you know, you're going into the next phase. You're in secondary. And I don't know. I just, inside of me was like, maybe it was denial, but I was fighting and I was going to fight hard. There was just no way I was giving up. I fought my way through that 8 years to be healthy, and I was going to find a way to do it again. And I remember going on, you know, Facebook was still like pretty big, more than Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
Facebook was the big social media still at the time. And I, you know, people had Instagram, I think, but Facebook was really where it was at the time. And I remember just scrolling through Facebook, and I don't know, you know, we always say our phones listen to us and, you know, things have a way of working out with algorithms and things. I don't know what happened, but I came across some article about this transplant being done. I think at the time I saw it being done in Israel. And it just piqued my interest, and I started doing some research, and then I found that it was being done in Russia and in Mexico. And I started just digging deeper, and I thought, okay, I'm a single mother. I can't go to Russia. Like, I can't just go to Russia and leave my child behind.
Right.
And I wasn't pulling her out of high school. She was in her junior year of high school. At the time she was in her junior year. And that fall, she was obviously going to start her senior year. So I thought, there has to be something more. Also, Jen, I couldn't afford to not, like, I couldn't right. afford something that insurance wasn't willing to cover.
No.
Like, I didn't have that kind of money. I was right. scraping by as it was as a single parent. I just started, you know, this is something that I always say, this is one of my strong suits. This is something I really like about myself, is that I dig into research. I'll dig until I find the answer. And I just started digging. And that's when I came across Dr. Burt. I found that there was this doctor who kind of pioneered this procedure. You know, when he was in school and doing like residencies or something, he was working for another doctor, and they were doing these transplants on patients with cancer and blood cancers. And he said, you know, to the guy, well, why can't we try it on this? And they did. And fast forward, I reached out, and that's how the rest came about.
Mm.
And, you know, my insurance, I fought my insurance. They were like, no, no, no. I went through four rounds with them, and they said, we're closing your case. I had doctor to doctor peer reviewed stuff. They turned me down. They said it's experimental mm. and investigational. And it, you know, and I remember saying to them on the phone, I had this case manager, and I remember saying to her, let me ask you a question. If I had cancer and this was the treatment, would the insurance company pay for it? And she said, yes. And my words out of my mouth, word for word, my hand to God, I said, then you are going to pay for this too.
Wonderful.
And that was that. I fought. I hired an advocacy group that helped me understand how to put everything together, went through my records, and just like really helped me figure out how to do the work. So I did all of it, and I put it together, and I sent it. So I was working from home, and my company was based in New York. So my insurance was held in New York. I went to the state of New York, and I fought my case. And in the end I won.
Wonderful.
And the insurance company had to pay every cent of it.
Nice.
So another thing, you know, not only do you need to listen to your bodies and pay attention and keep track of your symptoms as they're happening to you so that you have accountability for yourself. But when you are told something, no, or we're not going to do this, don't give up the first time. So for all of the listeners that are new or that are going through what we went through early on, do not give up the fight. because you're the one that's fighting for something. Most of these doctors, in fact, probably 99% of the doctors we see aren't living with the disease.
Right.
They study it. They went to school and they did a specialty round, and or they're neurologists, and that's a part of what they do.
But they have no idea what it's like to live with it.
And even the researchers, you know, I had gone so far as to reach out to a couple of research doctors at, I don't know if it was at Stanford, one of the big hospitals out in California. Once I was able to get a hold of some of the researchers that were doing MS research, and I asked them questions. I'm telling you, when I dig, I dig. And he said, we don't have the answers. There are no answers yet. You know, these are why we do all these trials and we're trying to do all this research and study it. But right now there aren't any answers. And I just feel like people can't give up their own fight. So when you get turned down by an insurance company, don't give up on the first try. Fight them. Fight back. Get a hold of your own medical records. Keep a copy of everything. And when the doctors tell you something that doesn't feel right or that doesn't sit well with you, fight back. Because again, they don't have the disease. And I used to say that to the doctors. I used to say, I respect you and I appreciate you taking me as a patient, but you don't have MS and you don't know how I feel, you know, and I had to get them to be a little more compassionate and get to say, you're right, I don't. And I would say, then you have to listen to your patients, listen to them, try to understand it from that point of view, instead of telling them no, or this doesn't work, or do this and you know, it won't work. Be honest. Help us. So I had the transplant, and at the time I had the transplant, which kind of circles back to the worst of the symptoms, and the C2, C3 lesion, was at the time I saw Dr. Burt for my pretesting, they found that I was in an active attack at the time, which for some reason, and I don't remember what this is, and maybe you do. If you were active at the time, somehow they felt the transplant would be more effective. Mm-hmm. Am I getting that right?
Yes.
I feel like that,
yes,
that was correct. So he said it was actually to my benefit, mm-hmm, that I was active. So I had to do a round of steroids before, I think I ended the steroids, like when I finally started, the harvest. I think I just finished a round of the steroids. And at that time, my neurologist who I'd met with, who didn't know that much about HSCT, but said to me, you'd be crazy not to do it. Mm-hmm. This is the best chance you have of getting your life back. Because I asked him to look into it and do his research. And he said, you know, we sat in his office, my mom and I, because she came to every appointment over the years. And he said, you know, she was crying and she's like, but she could die and this and that and all these bad things. And I remember him looking at her and saying, she's dying every day. Mm-hmm. Right now, she is so sick. She is dying every day. And I, you know, we all go into this knowing what could happen, but we also all go into it because it's, for us, it's like the last chance that something could really make that much of a difference. And it did, you know, we're lucky it did. And so,
indeed,
I feel very lucky fortunate, indeed. But I was at the point where they said, you know, if you have one more attack that hits your cervical spine, you will be paralyzed from the neck down and you will be on a feeding tube. Mm. And I said, I can't do this. I'm willing to take the chance. And if I was not going to survive this transplant, then I was going to go out fighting. And that's what I told my daughter when I had to leave her starting her senior year, because I had to go back to Chicago to start the harvest in September. And she had just started her senior year of high school. So she was going through that process of putting all her college applications in and doing all her work. And I was leaving her behind to do that. And I had to sit her down because I had to have that conversation. I didn't know if I was going to come back.
Right.
We don't know that. And I just remember having that conversation with her of, you know, you have all of the information, you have every bit of knowledge to start your life, to go to college, to become a grown up. You know, everything I've taught you, it's inside of you now. You know it. And it was hard, but I was ready. I was ready for anything that this was going to do, because I had to show her that you don't give up. You can't give up when things get tough, or when things don't feel right, or you get scared. You've got to walk into the fear. You've got to say, I can do this. I can fight this. And for me, that was one of the big reasons also, was I needed to show her and give her that lesson. Because if I didn't come back, I wanted her to remember that we do that. And I remember she flew up 2 days before my transplant. So I was just finishing the chemo, and then I had day zero, and she came to Chicago, and, you know, I was, you know, that moment when you just have nothing left in you and you're just weak and you can't really even get out of bed. And, you know, I said, go out, explore Chicago, go have some fun, you know, don't sit here with me the whole time. And the morning of the transplant, as you and some of the listeners know, it's really emotional.
Very, very.
I mean, it is so emotional. And we went through everything, and then she had to catch a flight to go back home. I wanted her to leave, because I also knew, which we had been informed of, that the first couple of days are the worst after the transplant. And I didn't want her to be there the next day. I want her to go home and let me get through this. And so I remember her standing at the edge of the bed, and I looked at her and I said, what have you learned through this process that I've gone through? What do you see standing here by my bed today? And we were all crying, and she just looked at me and she said that we can do anything. We can do hard things. And I was like, I'm done. My lesson's taught, you know?
Right. Well, I'm sure that was fulfilling, right? As a mom.
Of course. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And, you know, and went through the journey, and it got a little rocky in the hospital, and there were things that happened. You know, people can go back to the earlier episodes with me to hear that. I don't want to get into it, but. And so when I left, you know, a couple of things that I'm really feel good about, and I know, you know, Dr. Bird is not practicing these transplants in Chicago. He's out in California, but, you know, there were some things that were changed because of things that happened. I was able to go to the staff at Northwestern and the administration and the chief of staff and get some policies changed. And that was really important to me, because it mattered to me, the next round of people that were coming through. And I just wanted everybody to have a higher level of safety and things like that. And so, and then the work begins, you know, we go home and we start to heal and fight back.
And so
here we are.
Yeah. How's healing been for you the last 6 years?
I'd say healing's been really good. You know, at 47, when I went into the transplant, I was in early onset dementia. So they wanted to give me a Alzheimer's patch to wear, which I also refused. And so that, you know, having that be one of the biggest changes is that I can have conversations like I'm having with you.
Right. And you can,
and I can
return to a point that you're trying to make.
Exactly. And so, you know, am I 100% cured? I don't think this is a cure. It's a place where we get to stay for as long as we get to stay there. And I'm, you know, I'm a very realistic person in the fact that there may be a morning I wake up and the MS shows itself. But God willing, I will go a good 20 more years. You know, I'll get into my 70s in remission. That's my hope, is that I can go as long as possible, watch, you know, walk my daughter down the aisle, you know, see my grandkids and still stay this way. That's that's my goal. And my cognition is much better, but I'm also aware that I'm still a person living with MS. I'm still considered an MS person, an MS patient, or whatever. And that, again, it could come back, but I don't live that way. I don't, now I just live for today going through the experience of the transplant, and especially the experience that I went through with the people that I went through with, gave me a whole new perspective. When I was laying in Chicago, I grew up of the Jewish faith, but not religious, extremely reformed. And I didn't understand even the word faith, other than it was a friend of mine from high school's name. I did not know any meanings behind that. I didn't learn it. I didn't know. And when I was laying in Chicago for a couple of days that were really, really touch and go, I had to find something bigger than myself to believe in so that I could believe something was guiding me. And in those days, I found what I understood to be faith. And this transplant changed who I was, changed me. And, you know, I've said this, and I've talked to people over the years, and I felt like, you know, there's other people that have felt this way too. Some people, it doesn't change your DNA. You get a new booted immune system.
Right.
But your DNA is the same you're born with.
Mm-hmm.
But something felt different inside of me. And I don't know how else to explain it, but I felt like a different person. And maybe it was being so close to mortality. Maybe it was the experiences I had, but I couldn't go back to the life I had been living all my life. I could not. I could not go back to that person. I could not go back to those experiences. And everything changed. I just started to, you know, appreciate life. And I just never want to take a day for granted anymore. You know, even if it's a Netflix and chill day that I stay home and don't do anything but watch TV, I do it with intention now.
Right.
And when I go through episodes of my depression, which I will note, this is a personal experience only, it got much worse after the transplant. That was the one setback for me, is that my mental health got much worse. And I'm now with an incredible psychiatrist and on a really good, you know, cocktail of medications that seem to be doing a great job. But I've gone through, you know, a bunch of bouts of pretty heavy depression. And even in those moments when I've had them in the past, and I would just sit in that darkness, now I sit in there with intention of, okay, I'm aware this is happening and I can't seem to get out of it yet, but I'm going to feel all my feels. I'm going to learn, what is this episode teaching me today? What in my life has led me to this point in the last months or years? What's happening that I need to learn from this? I never did that before. So that is part of like the new person I was becoming, was to be present through the good, the bad, and the ugly. And I think that every day that I have lived post-transplant, has that has been my life now. And I love every bit of it. I love knowing that. You know, I went from having a career to moving to Key West and working in a little island organic cafe and shop. And I've, you know, without stress, without big city life, with surrounded by people I didn't even know existed in this world, because I had never met any of them where I lived. That I always say, like, I grew up having conversations that were right on the surface of the table. Just that was it. You had these conversations and lived your life. And coming here for the first time, I learned how to have the conversation under the table, if that makes any sense. It was like all of a sudden these conversations went so deep into my soul. I was able to open up and have these, meet these people and have these conversations that just opened me up, like just fully opened me up to a whole new world of self-love and mindfulness and being present. Cause I was living in the, I thought I was living every day present, but I've learned to do that in a much deeper level now. And I like that. I like this part of my life now. Mm. And, you know, is my cognition 100%? Absolutely not. I forget. I mean, I'm reminded by the people around me. Oh, you told me that. Oh yeah, we talked about that. You know, I forget things all the time. And we all do.
Absolutely. But we are all aging too.
We're all aging. And I know what my MRIs look like. Sure. Is my brain getting better? Yeah. Neuroplasticity. Thank God for that. But I also know that my MRIs contain several black holes. Mm-hmm. That damage is done. And my brain, I would still say 6 years later, is still rewiring itself. It's mm-hmm. still learning new pathways. And hopefully it always will. And so I'm so much better, but I think I always have little things, and some of the old symptoms show themselves. Like if I got, you know, get sick when I had COVID a few times, I think I had COVID 3 times.
Oh, and, goodness.
Yeah. And, you know, so little things come up, but then they go away and I never think, oh my God, this is what it is. Mm-hmm. You know, I've been battling some major neck issues for a couple of years. Well, I have 2 degenerating discs in my cervical spine.
Right.
You know, are they from what I went through? Are they from the MS over the years? Are they from the chemotherapy? I mean, I have my last DEXA scan a couple of years ago did show that my bones are a little softer. You know, they said you're in the early phases of osteoporosis. And I believe that that was chemotherapy. Because I was, you know, up until the transplant or until I got really sick, I was exercising pretty hard in those years and doing a lot of strength training. So I worked a lot on my bones.
And surely steroids didn't help either.
Well, a year of steroids didn't help either. Yeah. Right. So, you know, I have those issues. I'm in physical therapy now. I'm learning how to rebuild my strength. And live with the pain in my neck and the migraines that have continued, unfortunately. But again, I work through them. I find new ways of coping with them. And I find ways to go around the system. So if I can't lift the weights I used to, or I can't, you know, I find a different way to do an exercise that allows me to do it without pain. And I just keep learning new things.
It's
new ways
to
live my life.
Yeah, it's so important to stay malleable.
My food is, you know, just as good. I wouldn't say it's as clean. Like when I was preparing for the transplant, you know, I was determined to get my body into a very good pH balance.
Right.
So that, and it was. And I wouldn't say I'm as neurotic as those days, mm-hmm. but I'm pretty crazy about my food and what I put into my body. I think my biggest newest thing is that as of March 17th, I will be 1 year refined sugar free. So no
Wonderful.
Refined sugar, no coconut sugars, no kinds of sugars outside of natural sugars.
That's amazing.
Like fruits. I eat a lot of fruit. And that's been a big change as well in my body. And a level of inflammation, because my markers now for C-reactive are non-existent. So it's showing no signs of inflammation or disease.
Amazing.
You know, as far as the blood tests, not the scans, but the blood tests.
Sure, sure.
And so, you know, I just stay on this journey and I believe that, you know, what I put into my body is how my body's going to treat me back. So. Mm-hmm. And I'm still in the self-love discovery, as we all are as women, and, you know, go through aging and keep trying to be in acceptance of the time that passes. But I feel like I am probably in one of the best phases of my life because I'm living life on my own terms, in my own way. And I stopped listening to the outside noise of this is what you should be doing. This is what we think is better for you, or I don't live like that anymore. I live for me and what's best for me.
That's
despite
beautiful.
What anybody around me thinks, you know, this is how I am now. And I like that about myself.
That's very courageous.
So it's been a really good journey. And honestly, I would do it again. I would do the transplant again if I had to. Hopefully, I never have to.
Right. Hopefully, we're on that forever path of remission, but we'll see. Only time will tell,
I hope
right?
so. Absolutely. But we're going to continue living our lives and doing what we can to keep the fight.
Right. So one of my favorite questions is always to ask about a superpower that you gained in your experience with HSCT, which, of course, you have already named superpowers in the past, but I would think that they might remain just as malleable as we do. So maybe,
of course,
it has evolved for you.
I would say if I had to name a superpower, that boundaries. That would be my newest one, I would say, is learning to put boundaries around myself that allow me to keep my personal space safe for me. So, and I mean, what I mean by that is tuning out the outside noise. I was the kind of person that lived my life for most of my adult life. I lived by trying to take in other people's opinions. And so if other people thought it was better for me to do this or do that, I often listened thinking that, you know, because I didn't go to college and I didn't have that background and I didn't have, you know, I had a career, but it wasn't, you know, as people say, it wasn't like a high powered thing. And being a single mom and always like kind of living paycheck to paycheck to get things done, it gave me a lack of self-worth. And through this journey with HSCT and the last 6 years, I have learned that I am worth it and that my voice inside of me is the only thing that matters. How I feel and the things that I want for myself, and nobody will know them better than me. And if I make mistakes and I fall, they're my mistakes to figure out, not someone else's. So I would have to say that my superpower now is the ability to put that boundary around myself to say, I love you. You are welcome into this space all the time, but you can't get through this armor if it's negative. If it doesn't suit my life and it doesn't make our relationship better and it is negative and judgmental, you can't penetrate this. It's not going to happen. So
brilliant.
That's it. That's the newest.
You got to keep yourself safe, right?
Yes, absolutely. You know, happiness, which, and I'll say this, this has been one of the hardest things for me. Learning that happiness comes, I knew, let's say, I could talk the talk, but I didn't know how to walk the actual walk. That I would say, you know, happiness can only come from inside of you. Nobody, you can't look for it in the external. But I, for a long time, did look for it in the external. And a few years ago, my sister gave me this great big, like wooden, kind of like a wooden plaque. And on it, it says, choose to be happy. And the day she gave it to me, I hung it above my bed. And it has all the moves I've made in the last 6 years. It has always been above my bed. And when I go to sleep at night and I wake up in the morning, that's what I see first. So I get to make that choice to be happy within myself. And having depression, it sometimes easy to forget that and to look for happiness in an external source, something else to fill me up and give me the happiness. So every day I remind myself, no, being with another person in a relationship or being around family or being with friends or being at work, whatever it is that makes you happy, that's an enhancement to what's already inside of you. You have to fill your own cup before you can give to other people. And that happiness solely is within us. And so, you know, I think that's important.
And true. And brilliant.
So that's what I got on this update.
I love it. And I always love connecting with you.
Everybody who's new, thank you. I do too. And so for all the people that are new to the podcast and joining in, and people that are newly diagnosed and all this, I can't say that there's a better, I still even get calls from people just recently, someone I went to high school with who I haven't talked to in years, obviously. I mean, I've been out of high school like 30 years. I recently got a text saying, you know, that she had a friend's husband or somebody was diagnosed and they didn't know where to turn first. And it was a lot of emotions and, you know, could she connect us? And I said, of course, but you know, there's all these resources and this is one of the best. And I still tell people, you know, go to this podcast, go to this website. You're going to learn everything. You're going to hear a ton of stories. It's going to put a level of calmness in you because you're going to understand that you're not alone.
Right.
So, I mean, what you've created is just, it's just incredible.
Well, I wouldn't want to do it without you.
Thank you. Thank you. But kudos to, I can't even imagine at this point how many people you've helped through this podcast.
Right. And that's the beauty. I may never know either, and that's okay. Right. I'm happy just holding the space and feel so honored and privileged every time someone trusts me enough with their story.
Yes. And it's beautiful.
It really is. And, you know, honestly, it's amazing. I just had the idea and thought maybe it might help some people to not be as anxious as I was going into transplant.
Right.
Right. Like that's all that was my only hope, was just to help alleviate some of that stress and anxiety for people, because I walked in with too much and realized pretty quickly, like it wasn't necessary to have to carry all of that. And I probably would have done even better had I not had that stress and anxiety.
Right. But we didn't know better.
No.
You know, we didn't.
No.
And so by creating this and interviewing, I mean, it's got to be hundreds of people.
Oh, no. It's not even one. So actually, this is our 100th episode.
Oh, my gosh.
And I have interviewed upwards of 80. But there have been so many people I've re-interviewed, including you.
Right.
Right. For the start of each season. Yeah. So,
but even so, you know, even it's not even the interviews, I guess, it's the amount of people that it reaches and the stories that they get to hear of hope. And I mean, I feel like if we had this resource, I again, speaking personally, if I had been able to hear all these things, I would have felt a better sense of calmness that I'm not alone. I'm not, because being diagnosed, that initial phase is just, oh my God, I'm the only one going through this. This is so lonely. It's terrifying. Terrifying. But it doesn't have to be.
No.
So
I'm beyond grateful that we've reached every continent in the world.
It's literally unbelievable.
So many countries. So hundreds of thousands of people. It's just amazing.
Well, you know what? You're a very humble person, but you should be very proud of what you created.
Indeed I am. And honestly, I do. I think of Carol all the time. I think of you all the time. And I'm just so grateful that you helped me realize this vision and actualize it. Six plus years ago.
I know. I'm honored that I get to be the opener. It's been a great journey going through these and, you know, looking back on these things. Because some days it feels like it was a lifetime ago and other days it feels like it was yesterday.
Yes, absolutely. And it may always feel that way. It's so great to have you along on this journey.
Thank you. Thanks, Jen.
Huge thanks to you always, Allie Strong, for being you.
Thanks, Zen Jen.
And sharing your zest for life and your mindful approach to self-care and advocacy that is so important in life and can be really challenging for so many people to find and practice. But
it is. And I will say this one more time, you know, for people that do listen to these episodes, or I hope that they know, you know, reach out to Jen personally, reach out to me.
Absolutely.
You know, I am a certified coach. which I did after the transplant when I left my career. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there are people, we're out here to help you get through that beginning phase. So, or any phase, actually.
Right.
I mean,
recovery,
I talked to
too.
I've talked to a lot of people on both sides, and there's resources. And, you know, I always put myself out on your podcast, on these episodes, to say, you know, for anybody that listens on, I'm here if you want to reach out. So
thank you for being a resource.
Okay. Thank you.
And a genuine gem in the world.
Much
love to you.
You too. You too. Thanks for having me.
Oh, thanks for always being here. You take good care of yourself.
You too. You too.
I hate to sign off, but
I know
we have things to do.
We have to. We do. So you take care of you.
Yeah, same. And I'll be in touch for sure.
All right. Thanks, Jen.
Take care.
You too. Bye-bye.
Be sure to visit hsctwarriorspodcast.org, where you can find notes from today's episode, submit ideas or feedback, and connect with resources and the HSCT Warriors Incorporated nonprofit. As always, special thanks to musical genius Billy Alitzhauser for sharing his superpowers to create the soundtrack, edit, and produce the audio to make this podcast possible. You can find us both when you subscribe on SoundCloud, iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you find podcasts. It has been amazing to connect with warriors worldwide, and we would love to hear from you about how the podcast has helped your journey with autoimmune disease. Take a moment to connect with us on Instagram or share this episode with someone you know that would enjoy listening. In the meantime, we hope you'll tune in next Wednesday for another episode highlighting another HSCT warrior. Until then, be a snowflake and embrace your superpowers. Be kind. Be well. Jen Stansberry Koenig and the producers disclaim medical influence and responsibility for any possible adverse effects from the use of information contained herein. If you think you have a medical problem, please contact a licensed physician and take good care of it.